Tips for On the Section, page 91. Seek internal qualities, not titles or external appearance. So some people may believe that the titles a person has indicates whether he or she is a qualified spiritual mentor. However, this is not necessarily the case. Each Buddhist tradition employs an array of titles that can be confusing to newcomers and that are not necessarily used in a systematic fashion. Okay. So nowadays, the title Lama is used in a variety of ways. So before, remember he said that Lama, students were attracted to the knowledge and behavior of somebody, and then they asked that person for teachings, and that's kind of how they became a Lama. Okay? So now it's a little bit different. He says, in some cases, Lama indicates a Dharma teacher. In others, it indicates someone who has completed a 3-year retreat. Okay, so in some Buddhist traditions, they have all Buddhist traditions talk about a 3-year retreat, but how they do it can be very, very different. And so I know in the Kagyu and Nyingma, especially Kagyu tradition, you're learning a lot of the basic practices for that tradition. And when you do your 3-year retreat, some of the teachers have the people put on robes during that time. They don't have all the monastic precepts. I think maybe they have 5 or 8 or something. I'm not sure what they have. But after they finish the 3-year retreat, then they can be called lamas. Okay, so there it just indicates that you've done the retreat where you've learned all the major practices of that tradition. Okay, so it doesn't mean that you've studied extensively or that you've been recognized as some highly realized person or anything like that. Okay, some people who are qualified teachers, but out of humility do not want to be called Lama. While some people who have not done extensive study and practice are eager to assume that title. Okay, I've seen both of those things. Geshe is a degree awarded by the large monasteries after the completion of many years of serious scriptural study and debate. In general, Geshe's have vast learning in the scriptures, and some also have meditative experience and realizations. However, after completing their studies, some Geshe's are eager to go abroad, not just to teach, but to receive offerings. Okay, and then as I explained yesterday, or the day before, when you enter the monastery, you have a class, and as your class progresses, as long as you stay enrolled, then whether you do all the studies or not, then you can become a Geshe at the end of when the whole program is over. Because the rigorous study program that they have in the Tibetan monasteries with debate and memorization and all, that style of learning and practice doesn't suit everybody. Yeah, it suits certain personalities and certain people, but it doesn't suit everybody who wants to practice the Dharma. And so, some people want to do social service, some people more meditation, some people want to study the Lamrim more. Not everybody is interested in that systematic program that they have in the monasteries. So gradually as the class advances, some people leave. And some people, remain in the monastery, but they work for the monastery. So they might manage the office, might manage the kitchen, the clinic, or something like that. So they're creating virtue by offering service. It's very good. But some of them are called Geshe at the end of the program, although they haven't done all those studies because they were working at the time, okay? So the basic point is, as His Holiness mentioned here, titles may indicate something and they may not indicate what you think they're indicating. Okay. And His Holiness's point that we'll see as we go on is that we have to look for people's qualities, not look at titles. Okay. And we know this from secular things too, don't we? Yeah. People have all sorts of titles and they can, you know, some of them are brilliant and some of them are lacking. Okay. So Kenpo indicates an abbot of a monastery, and Kenzer a former abbot. Although in some Tibetan traditions, Kenpo is an educational degree similar to Geshe. So when you hear Kenpo, you don't know, are they an abbot or is that an educational degree? Okay. Genla is used to address adult monks. It can be used to address our own Dharma teacher or even teachers of secular subjects as well. Okay. Chula is the respectful way to address a nun. Anila, actually it means auntie, although Geshe Dadol doesn't agree with me. He says it doesn't. But I know from other sources it means auntie. Most of us do not like being called auntie. Okay? So that's why in the West we changed it to venerable. You know, but in Tibetan, chula is the respectful way to address a nun. Okay. Tulku is a title given to someone recognized as the incarnation of a previous master. Tulku literally means an emanation body of a Buddha. But not everybody with this title is an emanation of the Buddha or even a bodhisattva. And there are different levels of tulkus according to the respect and renown of the previous master. Okay. Rinpoche, which means precious one, is often used to address tulkus. Okay. Some students call their teachers who are not recognized incarnations Gen Rinpoche, which means precious teacher, to indicate their respect for their teacher. Yeah, so Gen means teacher, Rinpoche precious. But having the title Rinpoche does not indicate that one has spiritual realizations. Yeah, and when you hear it, it may be somebody's teacher or it may be referred to somebody who's an incarnation. There's all sorts of levels of the Rinpoches. And His Holiness says it's basically social status nowadays. In old Tibet, there were a few Rinpoches, I mean, some, but not tons of them. Since they've come in exile, every Tashi, Lobsang, and, you know, instead of Tom, Dick, and Harry, it's Tashi, Lobsang, and who else? Tenzin, you know, wants to identify the incarnation of their teacher. So, His Holiness is flooded with requests to identify the incarnation. I've spoken with His Holiness's brother, who himself is a Rinpoche, a recognized reincarnation, and His Holiness's brother is very much against the whole tulku system. Yeah, he says it's you know, recognizing the incarnation of every single Geshe just leads to a tulku explosion, you know, with so many of them. And yeah, he just says he's not for it at all. You know, the idea of the tulku system, there's two things. One is if you recognize the incarnation of somebody who was a really wonderful master or skilled meditator in their previous life, then if you recognize them, then you can make sure they have a really good education this life. So that can be valuable. But it's also a way to pass down property, because clearly the monks do not have children. They better not. And And but the Labrang, the monks, the Rinpoche's household receives many, many offerings. When the Lama dies, when that Rinpoche dies, you know, what do they do with all the property in the house and everything that's been offered? They pass it down to the next incarnation. So they find the child, bring the child to the Labrang, to the house, and then raise the child in the monastery and, you know, with a monastic education. Some of those recognized lamas, recognized Rinpoches, remain monks. Nowadays, many of them disrobe because modernity has had a really adverse effect or a challenging effect on the monasteries. Yeah, it used to be, and this is what the Tibetans themselves say, it used to be that the families would send their brightest child to the monastery. Now they send their brightest child to sell sweaters to make money for the family or go to school, and they send another child to the monastery. Okay. So having the title Rinpoche does not indicate that one has spiritual realizations. Some may be manifestations of Buddhas or of Arya Bodhisattvas, those who have directly perceived emptiness and compassionately manifest to benefit sentient beings. Others may be lower level bodhisattvas who have not yet eradicated afflictions and are not able to control the rebirth process. Still, other people are identified as incarnations of great masters due to their accumulation of merit in the past, even though they have not entered even the first of the five bodhisattva paths. We should not assume that everyone who uses the title Rinpoche is a realized being. I have one friend in the West, and I've seen it in other cases too, where lamas may want to recognize a person who has a certain influence or a child of a particular family. They may want to recognize that child as a Rinpoche. Yeah. Yeah, one of my friends was a teacher at a Dharma center, and one teacher came and, you know, was talking about recognizing him as a Rinpoche, and he said, "I'm not a Rinpoche." Yeah. Okay. The system of recognizing incarnations of previous spiritual masters is a Tibetan cultural tradition. It is not a practice taught by the Buddha. In the 1960s, I discussed limiting the number of tulkus, but one advisor told me that would be difficult because it is the Tibetans' custom. Nowadays, being recognized as a Rinpoche has become a position of social status, not one of religious import, and this is not healthy. And I've heard His Holiness many times in a public teaching tell the Rinpoches that they shouldn't just rely on a title, but they should study hard and be good teachers and practitioners in this life, and not just coast along on having the title. We should seek teachers who are well educated in the Dharma, practice it sincerely, and have compassion for others. In looking at Tibetan society, I often see people ignoring learned geshes and genpos, but showing great respect to Rinpoches who are not learned. I tell young Rinpoches that they should not rely on the reputation of their previous lives, but should study diligently, practice sincerely, and be humble in this life. If they do, they will be an honor to their predecessor's name. If they do not, and merely use their social status to manipulate or deceive others, they are a disgrace, not only to their predecessor, but also to the Buddha Dharma. That's pretty strong, isn't it? Nowadays, many people look for the incarnations of their deceased teachers. but letting a child speak for him or herself is better. A child may display obvious characteristics, such as remembering a previous life or reciting texts not memorized in this life. In such cases, we cannot fail to recognize that the child is unusual. Only then should recognition as a toku possibly be beneficial. Okay, so when the child themselves has behavior that is unusual, then recognizing them as a toku and giving them a special education makes sense. So along this line, I remember when I first went to Coupon, there was a young toku. He's an adult now, but he was maybe, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 at the time. And I heard that sometimes in his sleep, he would recite texts that he had not memorized in this life. Yeah, but he had been identified as the incarnation of one of Lama Yeshe's teachers, who was a very well-respected Lama. Okay, His Holiness continues, I favor allowing children to grow up naturally and to develop their qualities in this life. Those who have gained special spiritual relations in the past will naturally progress in their own practice and benefit others in this life, whether or not they've been identified and given a title. Okay, so you can see in the other Buddhist traditions, yeah, you know, many people come when they're young and enter the monastery and nunnery. And then the ones, you know, some by their study, by their practice, you know, people notice them and they're special. And you can see that, you know, because the child themselves show it, or as they grow up and be an adult, you know, they show their qualities are apparent. And so His Holiness is saying, you know, look for those qualities and don't just look for titles. Yeah. And it's really funny, sometimes you get Westerners who come into the Dharma and, you know, everybody kind of goes through some phase of like, oh, maybe I'm a Rinpoche, but I don't know it. Yeah? But then some people really hang on to that and think, oh, I am a Rinpoche, and how come they haven't recognized me? Yeah? We're all actually a rebirth, an incarnation of somebody. I'm not so sure we want to actually be recognized as an incarnation of whoever we were in the past. Okay. Some people who were unknown in Tibetan society go to the West or to Taiwan and suddenly have many titles and are publicized as great teachers. And I've really seen this, you know. So, well, I'll read what His Holiness says. This is completely inappropriate. One Lama from Amdo commented to me that in the past, Lama's names were short, but the list of their realizations was long. Now they have very long and lofty titles, and the list of their realizations is short. And you see this sometimes when, you know, they send out notifications of somebody's coming, and you have it, you know, it's like, His Holiness, His Eminence, the very venerable so-and-so, Lama, Tulku, Rinpoche, you know, so, you know, like full of titles and one little name squeezed in there. And the Tibetans, you know, in India, they don't do that, okay? Have, you know, 6 or 7 titles in their name, yeah? So I don't know if it's their disciples that put people up or if they just come in and, you know, kind of do that. Teachers who are monastics must wear monastic robes. And those who are not monastics should not wear monastic robes or even maroon clothing that resembles monastic robes. His Holiness has said this many times. Some people listen, some people don't. Okay, and you will find people. One of the difficulties is that people will wear a maroon skirt. It's not folded in the way that monastics fold it, but it's the same color. And it's not stitched the way our robes are, but it's the same color. And then they shave their head, they put on, a maroon shawl. And then people get very confused and think that they're monastics, and they aren't. Okay. So His Holiness, or they'll come with their wife or their wear jewelry, and the students are going, wait, I thought they were a monk. What's going on here? So it's very confusing. Okay. I'll keep reading and you'll see what His Holiness says. The general public, as well as Buddhists, become very confused when they see a teacher whom they believe to be a monastic, but with a spouse and children. Lay teachers should wear lay clothes, or if they wear a long robe, it should be white, and their upper shawl should be predominantly white, but with some maroon stripes. So you'll see a Sakyatrizan. You know, that's how he dresses. He was, he's the leader of the Sakya tradition, and he has a wife and kids, but he always wears white with a maroon stripe, yeah. And he has long hair, and he doesn't at all pretend to be a monastic. But he's an excellent practitioner. For many years, I have recommended this, and I am happy to see at least some lay teachers follow my advice. Okay. Although the Buddha Dharma flourished in Tibet, the general public's level of understanding of the Buddha Dharma was low. Many people would look at the height of a teacher's throne or the number of horses in his procession to determine who to respect. Yeah, if they didn't... they didn't consider that a famous bandit would also have many horses in his caravan. Okay, so there's this great story of Pacho Rinpoche, really fantastic Nyingma Lama. He wrote a book, Words of My Precious Teacher, which I really love. And he, he was a very humble practitioner, so he was working for some lady, milking the cows or doing something like this. And then it was traveling, somewhere. And as they were traveling along the road towards their destination, then there were a whole lot of people, waiting, like they were welcoming somebody who was really important. So this lady was from a rich family, and she was thinking, oh, well, that's really nice. They send out all these people. And then it turned out they were sending it out for Pacho Rinpoche, not for her. But he was the guy who was taking care of the animals and milking the cows and stuff. So, in Tibet, and now in exile, some people place great emphasis on external appearance. Brocade robes, colorful costumes, and the shape and size of hats. When you look at His Holiness, the pictures of His Holiness from before 1959, when he was very, very young, and he was very strongly under the influence of Tibetan customs and the regents and his teachers, you'll see that he was wearing brocade outfits, not robes. Yeah. And then he came into exile, and he was more of an adult, and he got rid of all the brocade things, and then he was wearing robes. Okay, so he himself said, because in old Tibet, and still now, the tradition is very important, showing respect for the teachers. So how could the Dalai Lama not wear brocade? Okay. So that's what he grew up wearing, but then when he had a choice himself, he got rid of it. So in Tibet and now in exile, some people place great emphasis on external appearance, brocade robes, colorful costumes, and the shape and size of hats. But our teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, did not have a hat. Nor did he wear special robes. His robes were the same as those of other monastics. Even though some of the Indian masters, such as Asanga and Chandrakirti, are depicted with big hats, it is questionable whether such hats were worn in the great Indian monastic universities such as Nalanda. Okay. In Tibet, there was perhaps some reason for wearing a hat. And you see, in other Buddhist traditions, they don't have this big thing about hats, you know. If it's cold, they put a beanie on their head and that's it, yeah. But in the Tibetans, you know, brocade hats and all the, you know. Okay, so in Tibet, there was perhaps some reason for wearing a hat because the weather was cold. Bald teachers especially found hats helpful. However, Tibetans went to an extreme and made hats in elaborate shapes, sizes, and designs, so much so that some foreigners came to distinguish the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism by the color of their hats. This is very unfortunate. In addition to the yellow, red, and black hats that are so famous, perhaps monastics nowadays could wear green hats, indicating that they care for the environment. Okay, at the Abbey, we wear sun hats. So we're the sun hat school. Okay. We must try to understand the essence of the Buddhist teachings and the commentaries of the great Indian masters. This is what he says again and again and again. This is what's so important. By doing so, we will see the true gauge for evaluating the quality of a teacher is his or her understanding and behavior. Faith in spiritual teachers should be well earned. Some great teachers, such as Milarepa, look like poverty-stricken beggars, yeah, and yet had great realizations. The Kadam master, Drumdompa, was a humble nomad. The 20th century Dzogchen master, Zapatro Rinpoche, looked like an ordinary wanderer. These truly great spiritual masters had no external appearance of grandeur. Our priority should be understanding the meaning of the Dharma, not wearing elegant robes, donning colorful costumes and hats, sitting on expensive seats, or riding in luxurious vehicles, and may I add, wearing gold Rolex watches. Nowadays, we have to add sporting... Oh, it says that in the next... Nowadays, we have to add sporting expensive watches and displaying a range of costly technological gadgets to this list. You know, pulling out the smartphone and the this and the that and the other thing. Of course, every Lama says this when teaching, but in their own lives, some do not follow it. His Holiness can be very blunt, you know, says what he means. Recently, the emphasis on elaborate rituals, complete with drums, cymbals, dances, and colorful masks, has increased in the Tibetan tradition, and the emphasis on teaching has diminished. The time has come to change this and to return to the Nalanda tradition of ancient India. Practitioners' philosophical views and conduct must be grounded in the teachings of the Buddha and the great Indian masters. We must simplify ceremonies and rituals. Oh, thank goodness. If you've ever lived in a Tibetan monastery, they can chant from morning to evening and still keep going. You know, the rituals sometimes, I mean, can be very, very lengthy. And rituals, some rituals, they're really wonderful and inspiring. But sometimes, if you're like me, you want to do something else besides chant. Yeah. Like, how about some meditation? Yeah. Okay. We must simplify ceremonies and rituals, strengthen our philosophical understanding, and implement the teachings in daily life. If we do this, Buddhism will play an important and meaningful role in the upcoming centuries. If we do not, it could degenerate into mere show. It is important for all of us who consider ourselves to be followers of the Buddha to constantly check our motivation. In my own case, whenever I sit on a high throne to teach, self-importance and pride seldom arise. Even so, I notice that occasionally my thoughts become defiled by the 8 worldly concerns. I think how nice it would be if people complimented me on the Dharma talk, and how disappointed I would be if they criticized it. You know, people coming up and saying, the teaching you gave was so wonderful. Your teachings are so great. Whenever two people say that to me, your teachings are very good, I say they aren't my teachings. They're the Buddha's teachings. I'm just repeating things. But, you can get really humble. They like that. They like how I led the meditation. They think I'm so good. And then one day somebody comes up and says, I can't understand anything you say, and doesn't make any sense anyway. Yeah. Or, your teaching was okay, but I'm going to continue going to that other Dharma center. I like the teachings there better. So then you see the 8 worldly concerns come up. So I think how nice it would be if people complimented me on my Dharma talk, and how disappointed I would be if they criticized it. Our vulnerability to worldly concerns is real, so we must be extremely careful. To ensure that we are engaging in genuine Dharma practice, we must check that our motivation is not defiled by the 8 worldly concerns. Otherwise, self-importance will lead us to have other faults. It then becomes easy to abuse power, greedily seeking offerings from the faithful, or manipulate others. We may even envy other teachers and compete with them. All of these corruptions arise once we become proud. However, when we honor the responsibility that comes with sharing the Dharma with others, we will constantly monitor our motivation and repeatedly turn our mind to benefiting others. Okay, so really warning us of the temptation, when you like reputation and praise and people giving you presents and to be recognized, and they wrote about me in this Buddhist magazine. Look, they have a 5-page interview with me. Look at that. And 1 page is a whole picture. They interviewed me. It's so easy, because everything in the West gets commercialized. Yeah. And, and then they place ads, this fantastic teacher, blah, 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 your one and only chance to, it's completely inappropriate, Announcements about teaching should be announcements, not advertisements, okay? You announce somebody's coming, this is what they're teaching, this is what the topic is about. You don't advertise, this is my opinion. This is the greatest, the one and only choice, this fantastic person, and then you'll never get another opportunity, and this is a secret teaching. And here's the donation. okay. It shouldn't be like that at all. Okay, so then the reflection. Why is following the guidance of a spiritual mentor important? So these are things you should meditate on. Okay. What kind of qualities do you want to look for in selecting a spiritual mentor? And are you easily influenced by titles, external appearances, and charisma? This is an important question to look inside. And what attracts me? How much am I attracted to, you know, the external appearances? How much am I attracted to charisma? If so, what ideas do you have for redirecting your focus to important qualities? Okay, so something to really contemplate. Okay, now the section becoming a qualified disciple. So we just spent many pages talking about how to look for a qualified teacher. You know, now it's like, let's turn the mirror this way. And how do I become a qualified disciple? So in addition to seeking qualified teachers, we must make ourselves into receptive vessels so that we can benefit from our mentor's instructions. We may receive profound teachings from excellent mentors, but without attempting to develop the qualities of a good disciple, the benefit will be minimal. Aryadeva describes the qualities of a disciple who will realize the meaning of selflessness. An unprejudiced, intelligent, and interested listener is called a vessel. Unprejudiced, intelligent, and interested. Okay. It doesn't say rich, big-eyed, and a fat wallet. Okay? It's not the qualities. So the first quality for suitable Mahayana students is being impartial and open-minded. Okay. We should try to be free from preconceptions and not close-mindedly cling to our own views. If we are biased, we will follow only the teachings that please our ego and accord with our own ideas. Dismissing valuable teachings that challenge our opinions hampers our spiritual progress. Okay. The thing is, it's very difficult for us to realize our own closed-mindedness and our own bias, you know, because we think that we're discerning things quite well. And this is worthwhile and this isn't. But actually, we could be very prejudiced. This teaching feels comfortable. This teaching makes me feel uneasy. You know, when the teacher teaches about the Buddha and light streaming into me, I love it. When the teacher teaches about karma and, you know, the 10 destructive actions and their results, I don't want to hear it. Okay? So it's hard sometimes for us to really be open-minded. Intelligence is the second quality of a disciple. This does not refer to intelligence in academic subjects, but to having the discriminative intelligence that can discern correct and incorrect views, as well as discern what to practice and what to abandon. Without intelligence, our actions, meditation practice, and view will be skewed. Okay? So, this is important to understand. Dharma intelligence and academic intelligence are two very, very different things. Okay? So don't think that because somebody has an academic degree, yeah, or a high IQ, don't think that that person is necessarily intelligent regarding the Dharma. Okay? Because such a person, due to past karma, due to the strength of different afflictions, can be totally, the Dharma can't go in. Yeah? They just cannot hear it. For example, you know, the people who, some of the scientists who are scientific reductionists, and you know, there only exist material things. The mind is the brain. Yeah? And I'm only going to believe things that, you know, I can verify scientifically. Okay. So that may sound great when you're in a university, okay? But in terms of the Dharma, that kind of attitude prevents the person from learning the Dharma. Because any discussion of the mind, of karma, of previous rebirth, of virtue and non-virtue, that person cannot take in. Yeah, they think it's a bunch of BS, to put it bluntly. Okay? So, on the other hand, you can have a person who's very bright in terms of the Dharma, who doesn't do well academically. Because so much depends on, you know, what we're familiar with and habituated with from previous lives. Yeah. It always helps to have a sharp mind and to be able to understand things quickly. But, yeah, being able to understand one subject quickly doesn't mean we can understand the other one. So, you know, so just because you didn't do well in school doesn't mean that you can't learn the Dharma. Yeah? Everybody comes into the Dharma with different predispositions. And, you know, some people can learn so well despite a lack of any formal education. Some people have a lot of formal education, and it really gets in their way sometimes. Other people have a lot of formal education, and it helps them in the Dharma. So it's very different from one person to the next. We can't make hard and fast observations there. Okay, but without Dharma intelligence, okay, then we don't think about when we hear different views about what the nature of reality is. You know, we don't get it. Or if we hear about, you know, practice these actions and abandon those actions, practice these mental states, abandon those, you know, we may not get it if we don't have the, you know, the intelligence. The thing is, you know, intelligence can also be developed in this life. When they talk about the mental factor of intelligence, there's four types. There's one that kind of comes with you from a previous life. Okay, that's the only one. The other three are developed in this life. Okay? The intelligence from listening to teachings and studying and learning them. The intelligence from reflecting, discussing, and debating them. And the intelligence from meditating them. Okay? So those latter three kinds of intelligence we develop in this very life. Yeah. So don't ever tell yourself, I'm too dumb to learn. Okay? If you tell yourself that, that's being dumb. Okay? Because it's not true. And if you don't believe me, put aside that idea and try learning. And then you will see the change in your mind. Intelligent and discerning disciples also examine the source of a teaching and are not satisfied unless they know it originated with the Buddha. They investigate if that teaching has been studied and explained by sages, actualized by yogis, and translated by excellent translators. Using reasoning and scriptural citations, they establish a teaching's validity. Okay? So they don't use the criteria of what was written about in the last Buddhist magazine, or what the latest psychological theory about mindfulness is. Okay? That's not the criteria that people use. Yeah? They really, like His Holiness said, they want to know the teaching originated from the Buddha, it wasn't made up last Thursday. They investigate if the teaching has been studied and explained by sages, people who are really good practitioners. If it's been actualized by yogis, if you can actually realize it. Yeah. And if it's been translated by excellent translators, so that, you know, because excellent translators are going to pick the really good teachings to translate. They're not going to translate fluff. Even if students are open-minded and intelligent, if they do not practice, they will not progress. Therefore, the third quality, interest, diligence, eagerness, and commitment to engage in the practice are essential for spiritual transformation. Two more qualities of a suitable disciple are often added to these three. The first, respect and veneration towards the teacher and teaching, makes us a receptive vehicle to receive the Dharma, whereas arrogance and apathy prevent spiritual growth. Appreciating our teacher's wisdom and kindness and respecting the excellent qualities of the teachings moistens our mind, making it receptive to the Buddha Dharma. Okay? So, you know, respect in American culture is not something that's emphasized a lot. We tend to be quite skeptical, disrespectful, as a culture, I think. Yeah. And the idea behind respecting other, you know, people with qualities is that if we respect those qualities, then we're making ourselves receptive to generate those same qualities. Whereas if all we do is ridicule and pick at people and tear them down, then we don't see their good qualities. And if we can't see good qualities, how can we develop them within ourselves? Because so much of our learning, we look at others with good qualities and then we think, I want to be like that. And then we start to familiarize ourselves with those qualities. But if we can't see good qualities, or if we're too arrogant to respect them, then we're really shutting the door for ourselves. Okay? The Tibetans have a saying that grass grows in the valley, not on the high mountains. Okay? So the realizations will grow in a humble practitioner. They won't grow in an arrogant one. Okay. So, we want to be impartial and open-minded, intelligent with discerning wisdom. And then also interested and sincere. Those are the first three. The fourth one is to have the ability to respect and venerate our teachers and people with good qualities and the Buddha's teachings. If we don't have respect and veneration for the teachings, why in the world are we studying them? We won't study them. We'll go read comic books or search the internet for something. Okay. And then the fifth quality is attentively taking the teacher's advice and instructions to heart, by putting them into practice, and that enables us to plumb the depth of the teachings and integrate them into our very being. Okay. Do not think that these instructions must be given one-on-one. Even when we are in an audience of 1,000 people, our mentors' spiritual instructions remain the key to actualizing the path. Okay, so another quality of a good disciple, one who attentively takes the teacher's advice and instructions to heart. So instead of dismissing it and saying, oh, that's too hard, forget it, or that's too simple, forget that, or I don't feel like doing this, forget that one. Yeah, so all of our various ways of kind of signing off on things without engaging in the teachings. So again, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Okay, we're making it hard for ourselves. And His Holiness has a very good point here, because sometimes we think, oh, okay, you know, I want to really take the teacher's advice and instructions to heart. But that means what the teacher says to me personally. Yeah. What they say to the whole group is not meant for me. They have to tell me personally. Yeah. Like when they say, bring me a cup of tea. Oh, that's a personal instruction. I will definitely bring them a cup of tea. So get out of the way, because I'm going in the kitchen. Okay? So it shouldn't be like that. When we receive teachings, yeah. And, you know, when I listen to teachings from His Holiness, I mean, there's thousands and thousands of people there, you know. And it's not like He's looking me in the eye. Yeah. But, you know, when you have that kind of respect, then what somebody says, you really listen and you think of, you know, how can I, you know, practice this? How can I really nourish it inside myself? And some teachings you can see, you know, okay, they're too advanced for where I am right now, but I still respect them. And I remember them, and I will still listen attentively, even if I don't understand all the details, because, you know, if I listen attentively, I'm putting the seeds in my own mind. And then later, when my mind is more receptive and my intelligence has increased, then I can come back to this and think about it some more and actually understand it better. Okay? But if we just kind of say, oh, they have to tell me personally, yeah, what exactly my daily practice is. You know, can you imagine? I mean, many of our teachers have hundreds or thousands of disciples, and we think that they have to tell us individually what our daily practice is? Like, how long is that going to take them to do that? Yeah? But we want, you know, that personal attention. Forget when they say, you know, every day you should do this and this and this to a whole crowd. Forget it. But if they say individually to me, then I'll do it. Yeah? We're pretty self-centered, aren't we? Yeah. People who sincerely wish to attain liberation or full awakening will cultivate these qualities in order to become receptive disciples and increase the benefit they receive from listening to teachings. Okay? So what His Holiness is saying is these five qualities are things that we can develop in ourselves. It's not like you have them or you don't have them, or you're born with them or you aren't born with them. These are five qualities that we can develop in ourselves in this life. And the more we do that, the more we make ourselves into good vessels to receive the Dharma. Okay. So people who sincerely wish to attain liberation or full awakening will cultivate these qualities in order to become receptive disciples and increase the benefit they receive from listening to teachings. In doing so, they become more self-confident and responsible in their Dharma practice. With clear understanding, they will be capable of receiving teachings and empowerments from various spiritual mentors and lineages without becoming either confused or sectarian. Okay. Not falling into mistaken ideas of surrendering everything to the guru, they will not be led astray by teachers with impure motivations. Instead, these kinds of disciples will derive great benefit from relationships with qualified spiritual mentors. Their clarity of mind and good qualities will increase, and they will become good examples for newcomers on the path. This book began with an explanation of the two truths, the four truths of the Aryas, and the non-contradictory nature of dependent arising and emptiness. These instructions guide a practitioner of middle capacity on the path to liberation and enable a sharp faculty, advanced disciple, to ascertain the possibility of attaining full awakening. When you understand these instructions well, you will know the kind of qualities a spiritual mentor must have to guide a disciple on the path to liberation and full awakening. You will also understand the qualities a disciple must have to be a receptive vessel and the way the disciple should rely on the spiritual mentor. Okay? So he's saying here, if we really understand these foundation teachings, which are, we may call them foundation, but they are not easy. They're actually quite advanced topics. The two truths, the four truths of the Aryas, the non-contradictory nature of dependent and arising. If we understand these, then we'll understand, you know, and because if we understand these, we'll understand how they play a role and how it's so essential to realize these in order to be liberated from samsara or in order to attain Buddhahood. You know? And if we can understand that, then we see, okay, somebody who's well-learned and well-practiced and can explain these kinds of teachings, that's the kind of qualities in a good spiritual master. Not somebody who tells good jokes. Okay? Not somebody who pats me on the back and tells me how wonderful I am. Okay? You know, and then we see, okay, to become a receptive disciple, yeah, what kind of qualities do I need to have? Yeah, well, I need to somehow open this mind, you know, so that I can hear things that are new, so that I could hear things that maybe initially I go, huh? You know, so instead of just throwing things out, opening my mind to take them in, mulling them over, if I don't understand them, put them on the back burner for the time being, but don't throw them in the garbage can. Okay, because these are teachings that, you know, were taught by the Buddha, realized by the great sages. Now, I may not understand them now, but I'm not going to throw them out. Okay, so we try and make ourselves into a good disciple. To illustrate the importance of being an intelligent disciple, the Buddha gives the example of misguided people and intelligent ones who want to get the poison from a water snake in order to use it as medicine. So I don't know about water snakes so much, but apparently they have some kind of poison, and if you can extract that poison, you can use it as medicine for diseases. Okay, so Buddha's going to talk about misguided disciples trying to get that poison out of the water snakes and intelligent ones. Okay. So a misguided person grasps the snake's coils or its tail, enabling the snake to turn its head around and bite him. Yeah. Don't grab the snake's tail. You know? I mean, if you can think at all, like, if I grab that tail, what's the snake going to do? Yeah, it's going to turn around and bite me. Okay, so don't do that. The poison that this person sought to make into medicine now makes him suffer because he got bitten by the snake. Similarly, a person may hear or read the Dharma, but not think about it clearly. He thereby injects his own preconceptions into the teaching, twisting the meaning to conform to his ideas, and his ideas are based on attachment and animosity. Wow, surprising. Yeah, my ideas are based on what I'm attached to and what I don't like. Oh, I didn't know that. We inject our own preconceptions into the teachings. And then if we try and talk to somebody else, we teach them our preconceptions. Yeah, and that can be very, very damaging. Or due to ignorance, yeah, this person misunderstands the actual meaning of the teaching and practices that. That's really not so good. Okay. This person may also have the wrong motivation, learn the Dharma for the sake of criticizing others, or for winning a debate, or for becoming a big star in the Dharma world. Okay. So sadly, a person who incorrectly grasps the teachings often does not realize he is doing so, and instead proceeds to share his distorted understanding with others, harming not only himself, but others as well. This damage may affect many future lifetimes, our own and others' future lifetimes. Yeah. So that's why it's really important, you know, more important than who you marry, to find a good Dharma teacher, because it's going to really affect many lifetimes. On the other hand, intelligent people grasp the snake's head and by pressing it in a certain way, extract the poison and make it into medicine. So maybe you grab the head like right, you know, back here, and then the snake can't turn around. Yeah. It's like trying to get a cat into a cat carrier. You know, if you try and put it, the cat in front ways, forget it. They're not going to go in, okay? If you hold them by the scruff of the neck and lower them in with their tush first, they go in very easily, okay? So it's a similar kind of idea. Yeah? You have to learn how to do things. Yeah. Otherwise, the cat's going to hiss and, you know, maybe turn around and bite you, too. Okay. Similarly, wise disciples learn the Dharma and examine the meaning with wisdom. Through wise investigation, they will come to correct conclusions and accept the teachings. Their motivation is to derive spiritual benefit, and they succeed in doing this, thus bringing happiness to themselves and others for a long time to come. May we all be disciples like that. The Buddha concludes the simile with this advice. When you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. When you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then either ask me or those monastics who are wise about it. So don't make up your own theories. Don't throw it out the window. Don't twist it around to make it say something that it doesn't say, but that you can agree with. Ask questions. We too should ask our teachers and other senior Dharma students when we do not understand a teaching. Even when we think we understand a teaching properly, it is always good to check our understanding with those who are more knowledgeable and skilled in practice than we are. In that way, the Dharma will be wonderful medicine that cures our own and others' suffering. In case someone misunderstands the simile of the snake and thinks that Dharma is something to grasp onto and identify with, okay, so even the simile you can misunderstand, yeah. So in case somebody does that, the Buddha continues the sutra using the simile of the raft. This is a very famous simile. This simile illustrates that having understood the teachings correctly, we should use them to cross the ocean of samsara and reach the shore of nirvana without clinging to the teachings unnecessarily. A traveler comes across a large body of water. The bank where he stands is dangerous, but the far side is safe. The bank where we are is samsara, the far bank is nirvana. Since there is no ferry, there's no ferry there on strike, he binds branches together to make a raft and holding onto the raft correctly, paddles to the other shore. Feeling relieved upon safely reaching the other shore, the traveler should not hoist the raft on his shoulder and carry it around because of attachment to the raft. The sensible thing to do is to set the raft down and go on his way. Okay? So you got to the other side where you're going, you're safe. Do you need the raft anymore? No. Do you need to cling on to it? This is my raft. I made this raft. It's a beautiful raft. The perfect raft. The best raft. Made with my intelligence. Better than anybody else's. Okay. If you cling on to that raft and you carry it around with you, you know, you're going to make yourself exhausted. Yeah. So similarly, we are on the frightful, dangerous bank of the ocean of samsara. The other side is nirvana, and the raft to carry us there is the Dharma. When learning the Dharma, we must make sure we hold it correctly. However, once we attain liberation, or full awakening, we will not be attached to the Dharma, cling to an identity of being a Dharma practitioner, or boast of our attainment to others. So it's not like, oh, I built this raft and I sailed across the ocean and here I am with the best raft, look at me. You know, so it's not like, you know, I learned the Dharma and I have all these titles and I'm such an excellent practitioner, you know, who attained high realizations very quickly. Yeah. And now I have attained Buddhahood. And the donation basket is right here. You know, we shouldn't be attached to the Dharma or create an identity about it, you know. And somebody who has genuinely crossed over to nirvana is not going to do that by any means. Just as the purpose of the raft is to cross dangerous water, not to have something to carry around with us, the purpose of the Dharma is to liberate us from cyclic existence, not to give us an identity to grasp with attachment. So the Buddha says, also in this same sutra, when you know the Dharma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even the Dharma. How much more so what is contrary to the Dharma? Okay, so we shouldn't grab onto the Dharma as make it an identity that's something we're attached to. We should definitely abandon what is contrary to the Dharma. Okay. So the Pali commentary to this line indicates that here Dharma refers to serenity and insight. Practitioners should not get attached to even the peace of serenity and the sublimity of insight, let alone cling to wrong views, such as thinking attachment to sense pleasure is not an obstruction on the path. While exerting effort to cultivate serenity and insight is essential, we should not cling to the peacefulness that these states bring, but continue to practice until we gain complete liberation. Okay, so that is quite important. You know, we may experience very peaceful states while we're on the path, but don't cling to them as the final goal and think that you've gotten there. Okay, but we should continue to practice till we attain full awakening. The Buddha made a similar point in the Greater Discourse on the Destruction of Craving, where he questions the monastics regarding their understanding of how the four nutriments perpetuate the five aggregates of samsara. The monastics assure him that they have understood with proper wisdom not only how the aggregates arise because of the four nutriments, but also how they cease when their respective nutriments cease. So the Buddha replies, after the monastics say we've understood this properly, the Buddha says, "Monastics, purified and bright as this view is, if you adhere to it, cherish it, and treat it as a possession, would you then understand that the Dharma has been taught as being similar to a raft, to be used for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping?" "No, Venerable Sir," replied the monastics. Yeah. So a view may be correct and sublime, but if we treat it as a personal possession, create an identity out of it, or adhere to it with attachment, we have missed the boat. However, going to the other extreme and thinking we can cross the water without a raft is unwise, as is casting the raft aside before we have reached the other shore. So thinking I can develop my own path to awakening and I don't need to meditate on these kinds of things because they're too difficult, we're throwing the raft away. Open-minded and intelligent disciples will discern the correct view and then contemplate and meditate on it without clinging to it with attachment. Okay. So how can we tell if we're clinging to a teaching or a view with attachment? If we don't want to hear anything else. If the moment somebody else presents another idea, we go like this, like, "Oh, this is dangerous, I don't want to hear it." Yeah. So, if we react with some kind of fear like that, then we're clinging to something. Leaving the raft behind after reaching the other shore does not mean that those who are liberated give up the Buddha's teaching and do whatever they like. Okay, repeat. Because this is another story that some people misinterpret in the West. They say, "Oh yeah, when you get there, you can cast away the teachings like you cast away their raft. Don't cling to the Dharma teachings." And they take that to mean, well, then you don't really have to practice the path in a serious way, which is not correct. Leaving the raft behind after reaching the other shore does not mean that those who are liberated give up the Buddha's teachings and do whatever they like. They show their incredible gratitude and reverence for the Dharma by teaching others and guiding them on the path. By means of the similes of the snake and the raft, we see the importance of making ourselves into suitable vessels to receive and hold the Dharma. While having a fully qualified spiritual master is necessary to progress on the path, it is not sufficient. The more that we put effort into developing correct understanding and good qualities, the more our spiritual mentor will be able to lead us on the path to awakening. So it's a dual effort, our teachers and us, and we have to collaborate and make it a dual effort. And then the reflection, what are the five qualities of an excellent disciple? And how will developing each one help you on the path? This is, again, something to really think about in your checking meditations. What ideas do you have to increase the five qualities of a suitable disciple in yourself? And what have you learned from the simile of the snake and the raft and the simile of the raft? Okay, these are good discussion group questions. Okay. So, we finished the first chapter about the spiritual mentor. Maybe there's questions, comments. Yeah.
What are the four nutriments that's mentioned in that quote?
Oh, I should have put a footnote. Let's see if I can remember them. One is food. The other, they have to do with correct views, correct practice. One is food. One is, I think, consciousness. I can't remember exactly. Yeah. Okay. I would say look it up, but we don't have internet, unless somebody's computer has internet. Unless you can look it up. Okay. I should have put a footnote in about that, huh? Okay.
And just a comment as well. One of my teachers is a tulku, and he was taken from his family when he was three and brought to the monastery then. And one time it commented that it said, children should not be taken away from their families that young. From his perspective of just like, you know, I think the context of the conversation was that he found it traumatic. That as a baby, like a three-year-old, to be taken from the mother like that and then into the environment of raised in the monastery, is that it's interesting with the people who have received education should be the ones that teach. And this teacher was asked by His Holiness to teach in the schools for the Tibetan refugees that were escaping, the young kids. He taught in Kalimpong, one of the schools where Geshe Dado went for 30 years. So he didn't receive a traditional monastic education. So he refuses to teach because of that, even though he's requested. He's like, I haven't had the education, so I can't. And it always confused me, but now it makes a lot of sense, and it's more, it's the respect for...
Respect for the teachings, not for the title.
Could you explain what a realization is and how that differs from a spiritual experience?
Okay, as we learn I'll give the general meaning of a realization. We've just learned a technical meaning of it, but I will not go into that in depth now. But it means that you've really got it. It's, you know, you really understand something with a valid mind, okay? So it could be a conceptual realization, something like an inferential understanding of emptiness, where you really have very clear in your mind the correct view, and that can be something that very powerfully affects you. Or it could be a direct perception, for example, of emptiness or of impermanence, where you, with a meditative consciousness, what's called a yogic direct perceiver, actually know that object. It could be there's other kinds of realizations, like bodhicitta, where you're not trying to realize an object, but you're developing a quality within you. And so realizing that, or realizing the aspiration for liberation, is when, well, realizing bodhicitta is any time you see a sentient being, the thought of attaining awakening to benefit them arises in your mind. The realization of the aspiration for liberation is when you see nothing at all beneficial in samsara. And they say day and night, but it doesn't literally mean day and night. You can also go to sleep. You have that longing for attaining your spiritual goal. Yeah, you never slip back into, well, samsara has some good qualities, I should hang around here a little bit more. Yeah, now that doesn't come in mind. Okay.
I just wanted to clarify when you were saying when we are clinging to a teaching that we are reacting to something different with aversion or fear. Does that mean that when we are presented with something different, that we are like willing to kind of have a conversation and like understand what the other person is talking about?
Okay, what I meant was, one way to tell if you're clinging to a teaching is if you react with fear, like you're being threatened by another opinion. Yeah. If you can hear another idea without feeling threatened, you can still know your view is the correct view and be very clear about that. And you're not going to let yourself be influenced by another view. But you don't react with that thing of, oh, I'm being threatened. Okay?
A small one, when somebody has a Geshe Larampa, is that also a way to smooth along with a group, or do they have indeed, when they do the Geshe Larampa, do they have to excel in a certain way?
A Geshe Larampas, yes, they don't get their Geshe degree when the rest of the class does. They stay for several years afterwards reviewing and debating everything, and then they apply to get the Geshe Larampa and do the written test and the debating test and the memorization test. Yeah, in the monasteries, memorization is really stressed, and it's seen as a very admirable quality. So you have to memorize, like, sometimes these quite large texts, and then recite them at top speed in front of the whole monastery without making a mistake.
So a geisha doesn't have to go through all these tests?
If they're not a Geshe Larampa, no. Yeah. Like I said, you know, you'll meet monks that are called Geshe-la. You know, I mean, I know one, and we call him Geshe-la, but he set up a clinic at the monastery, and, you know, he was mainly working for the monastery. So he got his Geshe degree quite soon. He didn't, you know, stay on and get the Geshe Larampa at all.
And the four nutriments in the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation.
Oh, good.
So okay. It's the next verse from the one you quoted.
Oh.
It goes on and says, he gives a title called Nutriment and Dependent Origination, and the next verse goes, Bhikkhus, there are these four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that already have come to be, and for the support of those seeking a new existence. what for. They are physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle, contact as the second, mental volition as the third, and consciousness as the fourth. And then there's a footnote about this passage, and it says, on the four nutriments, see this other note, but then it says, the Buddha states that this passage and the following one, linking up the nutriments with dependent and origination, in order to show that he knows not merely the five aggregates, but the entire chain of conditions responsible for their being. And the other footnote talks more about the nutriments.
Okay. So they were food, contact, yeah. I didn't hear the
Physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle.
Yeah.
Contact. Mental volition.
Mental volition, so that's karma.
And consciousness.
And consciousness.
Yeah, and then they tie them up with the...
It's more just a comment. I don't think people realize that how confusing the robes can be when a lay person is wearing them. I knew of a Tibetan who was teaching with the robes, and I asked the students, "Is it a monk, a monastic?" And they didn't even know. They didn't know one way or the other.
Oh my goodness.
So, and I still actually don't know. Seemed to be a very good teacher, but still, you know, quite a bit of confusion. So,
yeah. Students should be able to know and to tell very clearly whether somebody's in the house to come by. Okay.